the insignificant outer edges of Jane Ambrose's life without ever coming close to capturing the essence of the woman she was, or understanding why she was dead. As far as we know, the last person to see Jane Ambrose alive was one of Princess Charlotte's women, who chanced to look out a window of Warwick House around midday and see Jane crossing the courtyard toward the gate. But after that... Sebastian paused. For some reason he could not explain, that moment haunted him. He kept imagining the slender, sad young woman, dressed in mourning for her dead children, walking across a neglected courtyard as the snow began to fall, and going... where? Where the hell had she gone? And why? Nothing, said Gibson. Not a bloody thing. I don't know where she was killed, when she was killed, or basically anything that happened to her from the time she left Warwick House until Hero and Madame Sauvage stumbled over her body in Shepherd's Lane. I can't even figure out what the hell she was doing in Clerkenwell. Sebastian took another deep drink. Clerkenwell? Of all places! Alexei said she was wearing her pelisse when she died. Sebastian nodded. Which means she was probably outside when she was killed. Although, since she wasn't wearing a hat or gloves, it's also possible she was simply preparing to go out, or had only recently come inside. As to why or how she burnt her fingers, I've not the slightest idea. Gibson shook his head. Who would want to kill a 33-year-old pianist? Sebastian grunted. More people than you might expect. At the moment, my list of suspects includes her husband, an Italian harpist, a Dutch courtier, and Nathan Rothschild.
Rothschild? You can't be serious.
I wish I weren't. I was inclined to doubt it myself until a certain royal cousin warned me quite explicitly that looking too closely into the German financier's affairs would be hazardous to my health. Gibson drained his ale and set the tankard aside with a dull clunk. Bloody hell. You think Jarvis himself could be involved in this? Sebastian met his friend's worried gaze.
I'm afraid so. Does her ladyship know? Not yet.
Gibson shook his head and said again, Bloody hell. Chapter 13. That evening, the snow continued to fall in big, fat flakes that hurtled down out of a hard sky. As was their habit of late, Hero and Sebastian gathered in the drawing room before dinner with Simon, fresh from his bath, and ready for bed.
What's this? Asked Sebastian, turning the page of a wooden book painted with barnyard animals as he sat beside his son on a low ottoman.
Ngakaki,
said Simon, pointing to a shaggy billy goat.
Sounded like goat to me, said Hero with a smile.
Your son is brilliant.
Of course he's brilliant. He has a very brilliant mother. And what's that?
Sebastian asked, as the boy turned the next thick wooden page himself. Simon smashed a fat finger down on the fluffy black lamb.
Kagiji.
Alas, they're all gagajis, said Sebastian, just as a knock sounded at the distant front door.
He looked over at Hero.
Expecting someone.
A stranger's voice could be heard below, mingling with that of their majordomo, Mori.
No, she said.
Tiring of his book, Simon scooted off the ottoman and tottered over to the long-haired cat curled up in one of the cane chairs near the bowed front window.
Gagaji.
The big cat looked at the boy through slitted green eyes and lashed his magnificent, long, thick tail, a movement that was not generally a sign of either affection or pleasure.
Careful there, young man, said Sebastian, rising to his feet as Mori appeared in the doorway.
A gentleman to see you, my lord, said the majordomo. A Mr. Liam Maxwell. He says it's about Mrs. Ambrose.
Sebastian exchanged a quick glance with Hero.
Show him up.
Hero moved to retrieve the fallen book and thrust it in a drawer.
Do you know who he is?
Sebastian shook his head.
I've no idea.
The man who entered looked to be in his late 20s. Of medium height and slim build, he was respectably rather than fashionably dressed, with fierce dark eyes and windswept dark hair that glistened with wet from the snow. It was obvious he was labouring under barely suppressed emotions, his features pinched with what looked like profound grief.
"Lord and Lady Devlin," he said with a perfunctory bow, "my apologies for interrupting you at this hour." "That's quite all right," said Sebastian. "Please come in and sit down, Mr. Maxwell. How may I help you?"
Their guest made no move to take a seat, but continued to stand just inside the door, his hat in his hands, his posture stiff enough to be almost hostile.
"I'm here because of Jane. Jane Ambrose."
Sebastian walked over to the small table where a decanter of brandy and glasses were warming by the fire.
"You knew her?"
Maxwell hesitated just a shade too long before saying,
"I've known her for years. Her brother and I once published a newspaper together."
Sebastian looked up, the brandy decanter in one hand.
"I'd no notion James Somerset was involved in journalism."
Maxwell shook his head.
"Not her twin James. I meant her younger brother, Christian. He and I were in school together at Westminster."
"Christian Somerset is Jane's brother?" said Hero, as if the name meant something to her. Sebastian himself had no idea who Christian Somerset was, but Hero was staring at Liam Maxwell as if she now understood something that had escaped her before. Maxwell nodded.
"I'm told your lordship is looking into the circumstances surrounding Jane's death, which doesn't make sense if she truly slipped on the ice the way the papers are saying."
Sebastian poured a healthy measure of brandy into two glasses.
"There will be no official inquiry into Jane Ambrose's death, because the palace will never allow any hint of scandal to touch the princess. But Jane did not slip in the snow and hit her head. It is not clear whether her death was murder or manslaughter, but she didn't die in the lane where she was found. Someone moved her body there after she was already dead."
"Dear God." Sebastian held out one of the brandies, and after a moment's hesitation, Maxwell took it and drank deeply.
"I want to help find whoever is responsible for this."
"You have an idea who might have killed her?" asked Hero. Maxwell glanced over at her, features of his face tightening with what looked very much like animosity.
"Not exactly. But you have some suspicions," said Sebastian. "To be frank, I thought you might suspect me." "Oh, should I?"
A muscle jumped along the man's clenched jaw.
"Jane and I were very close. Were you lovers?"
The abrupt frankness of the question seemed to take Maxwell by surprise. Rather than answer, he cast another glance at Hero, only this one was more embarrassed than hostile. The meaning of that look was not lost on her. Stooping to swing Simon up onto her hip, she said, "If you'll excuse us, Mr. Maxwell, young Simon here and I will say good night." He gave a curt bow.
"Of course, my lady."
The boy began to fuss in protest as they moved toward the stairs, and Sebastian could hear her saying softly, "Let's count the steps, shall we? 1, 2, 3.
"So were you lovers?" Sebastian asked again.
Maxwell went to stand before the hearth.
"No, we were not. But I can understand how someone might think that we were. Jane was very dear to me." "Was the feeling reciprocated?"
Maxwell turned his gaze to the flames.
"We were old friends. Nothing more. Nothing."
Sebastian studied the man's half-averted face. In the distance he could hear the low murmur of Hero speaking to Simon's nurse, Claire, followed by the whisper of her footsteps coming back down the stairs and slipping into the adjoining morning room.
Do you think Edward Ambrose suspected that his wife was being unfaithful to him?
Maxwell's head came up, his nostrils flaring.
But she wasn't. Yet he could have suspected it, couldn't he? If, as you say, you were close enough that some might think it.
Maxwell hesitated a moment, then nodded.
Which means he had a reason to kill her.
Ambrose didn't use me as an excuse to kill Jane?
Their marriage had long ago turned into something more closely resembling an armed truce than a marriage. The death last year of Benjamin and Lawrence, Jane's two children, ended what little good was left between them. Did Ambrose ever hit her?
Maxwell nodded again, his nostrils pinched.
He gave her a black eye at least once that I know of. And several times he left a mark on her face, just here.
He touched his fingertips to his left cheekbone at exactly the same place where someone had struck Jane moments before she died.
She told you he hit her?
No.
She always came up with some tale to explain the marks. She'd even laugh at herself for being so clumsy, but she wasn't clumsy. She wasn't clumsy at all. I could never understand why she protected him the way she did. Perhaps she was ashamed.
Maxwell turned abruptly to face him, his hand tightening around his glass.
Why the devil should she have been ashamed? He's the one who hit her. Some women are ashamed when their husbands or lovers beat them. I'm not saying I think they should be, because they shouldn't at all. But that doesn't alter the fact that it's a common response.
Sebastian took another slow sip of his brandy.
When was the last time you saw her?
Maxwell dragged a hand down over his haggard face.
The day before yesterday. I have a printing shop off Fleet Street, and she came in. Why? No particular reason? She was in the area and stopped by to see me.
It was a simple offhand statement that told Sebastian a great deal about just how close Maxwell's relationship with his old friend's sister had been.
Did she ever mention Anna Rothschild to you? I know she was upset when she recently lost her as a student. Why? Do you know of any reason why her last encounter with Nathan Rothschild might have frightened her? Frightened her? Oh. Why? What are you suggesting? Nothing at this point. Any idea what she was doing in Clerkenwell yesterday?
No. I can't imagine.
She didn't say how she planned to spend yesterday afternoon.
Maxwell shook his head.
I don't believe she had any lessons on Thursday afternoons, although she'd recently been to see Lord Wallace, so she may have scheduled something. Phineas Wallace, said Sebastian, sharper than he'd intended.
Phineas Wallace, the second Baron Wallace, was a prominent Whig politician and one of the Princess of Wales's closest advisers.
Yes. Why? Just wondering. When you saw Jane on Wednesday, how did she seem?
The younger man looked as if the question confused him.
What do you mean? Was she happy, nervous, afraid?
He thought about it a moment.
Well, she was worried about the princess, but then she's been upset for weeks now on account of this bloody betrothal the regent forced on Charlotte. The poor girl is in a panic, and Jane has been beside herself because of it. What betrothal?
Sebastian said. Maxwell's eyebrows pinched together in a vaguely puzzled frown.
Don't you know? To William, the hereditary Prince of Orange. They've kept it quiet because Orange wants to make certain his position in the Netherlands is secure before the betrothal becomes known. But it's all been arranged since before Christmas. As soon as he's confident they have control of the situation, there, it will be made public. You know this for a fact.
Sebastian had a sudden distinct memory of Jarvis saying,
The last thing the regent needs at the moment is to have Princess Charlotte's name bandied about in conjunction with that of a woman unwise enough to get mixed up in something as tawdry as murder.
He now understood what was so critical about the moment.
Maxwell threw down the rest of his drink. I wouldn't have said anything about it, except I assume, given her ladyship's relationship to Lord Jarvis, that you already knew. Truth is, as some would think me more than a bit daft coming here, her ladyship being Jarvis's daughter and all.
The statement did much to explain the animosity Maxwell had shown toward Hero before.
I wouldn't be looking into Jane Ambrose's death if I were Jarvis's tool, said Sebastian, if that's what you mean.
No,
I don't suppose you would. You said the betrothal has been arranged since before Christmas. So did something else happen at the court recently?
Sebastian asked.
Something that might have disturbed Jane when you saw her on Wednesday.
Maxwell hesitated a moment, then said,
Not that I'm aware of, no. I think she was simply angry with a lot of them. With the regent for caring more about his grand vision for rebuilding London than about his own daughter's happiness. And with Lord Jarvis for having pushed the Orange marriage in the first place. It's all his scheme, of course. They're going to turn the Dutch Republic into a monarchy and vastly expand its territory with the idea of making it into a powerful bulwark against the French. With poor Princess Charlotte as a hapless plum on the top of a pudding. Charlotte agreed to this.
She did.
Yes, that bloody father of hers.
He told her that if she didn't marry, he'd keep her locked up with stodgy old governesses and sub-governesses until the day he died.
She held out for a while, but she knew he could do it to her.
Hell, look at all those old maid aunts of hers.
In the end, she met Orange just once at a dinner party and agreed that very night to marry him. Jane told me she regretted it almost instantly.
Maxwell set aside his empty glass with a soft clink.
There's no turning back for her now, poor girl.
Another brandy,
offered Sebastian.
Thank you, but no, I must go. You needn't ring for a footman. I can find my own way out.
Sebastian walked with him to the top of the stairs.
When I asked Edward Ambrose about his wife's family, he never mentioned a brother named Christian. In fact, he led me to think she had no family left alive. Why was that, do you suppose?
Maxwell paused with his hand on the banister.
Probably because he wishes Christian Somerset actually were dead.
Any particular reason?
His lip curled.
Royal patronage is important for a playwright, isn't it? I imagine it's more than a tad embarrassing for Ambrose having a former radical journalist as a brother-in-law. Particularly one who spent the better part of 2 years in Newgate for calling the Prince of Wales a fat spendthrift, who persecutes his wife and oppresses his people.
When was this?
That we were in prison? From the 15th of January, 1808, to the 22nd of December, 1809.
Maxwell huffed a rough, humourless laugh.
They were kind enough to let us out a few days early, for Christmas.
Sebastian understood now why Hero had recognised the names of Christian Somerset and Liam Maxwell. Sebastian himself had been off fighting the Hanover's wars at the time, and had only been vaguely aware of the trial. Sebastian said,
I take it Jane didn't share her husband's attitude toward her brother. Jane was no radical herself, if that's what you're asking. Far from it, in fact. But she wasn't ashamed of us. Ambrose was always trying to get her to stay away from everyone in her family, but she wouldn't do it. When Ambrose gave her that black eye, it was over Christian.
Where does he live now?
Christian? In Paternoster Row, over his bookstore and printing shop. These days he publishes mainly travel guides and romances, along with the usual odd printing jobs.
So you're no longer in the newspaper business?
I am, but not Christian.
A spell in Newgate definitely has a way of dampening some men's passion for espousing reform.
Not yours.
Some of us are wiser than others.
Maxwell gave a sad smile that had the effect of making him look both younger and considerably more relaxed.
Jane always did say I'm more pig-headed than most.
Were brother and sister close?
Always.
He turned his hat in his hands.
If there is anything, anything at all I can do to help, you will let me know.
Sebastian studied the younger man's dark, haunted eyes.
I will, yes.
After Liam Maxwell had gone, Hero came down from the shadows of the morning room to stand beside Sebastian at the top of the stairs.
How much of that did you hear?
He asked, as the front door closed behind their interesting visitor.
I missed the first part. So, were he and Jane lovers?
He says they were not.
Do you believe him?
When it comes to murder, I have a tendency to believe very little of what anyone tells me.
He went to stand for a moment beside the front window and watched as their visitor walked away, head down, through the driving snow.
So exactly how radical are Christian Somerset and his friend Mr. Maxwell?
Not as radical as some. Their newspaper advocated for reform rather than revolution.
For which they spent 2 years in prison,
said Sebastian, as Liam Maxwell turned the corner and disappeared into the cold night.
They did.
I understand Christian Somerset has moderated his verbiage considerably since his release.
And Liam Maxwell?
Her eyes narrowed with a faint smile. Not so much. Sebastian kept his gaze on the now empty, snow-blown street below.
Given her brother's politics, I'm surprised the regent allowed Jane Ambrose anywhere near the princess.
I believe Jane was Charlotte's teacher even before Christian Somerset's arrest. And at one time, Prinny was pretending to be a Whig, remember?
Sebastian turned to retrieve his brandy and take a deep swallow.
That he was. Because the prince's father, King George III, was a Tory. The Prince of Wales had once publicly associated with the Whigs. But as soon as he became regent, he repudiated his old friends and allied the monarchy closer than ever with the most conservative and reactionary of the Tories. A cynical move that embittered the Whigs even more.
Hero said, "You think her brother's politics could have played a part in what happened to Jane?"
It doesn't sound like it. But her brother's old friend, Mr. Maxwell?
Perhaps. He didn't need to come here tonight and draw attention to himself.
No, but I would have become aware of his existence soon enough. He might have thought it wise for him to make the first move.
Sebastian came to stand beside her at the fire.
How much do you know about him?
Maxwell?
She shook her head.
Only what was in the papers at the time of the trial, and I suspect that was biased against him.
Most journalists at the time were anxious to be seen as currying favour with the prince.
He slipped an arm around her waist to draw her closer.
Fess up now. Did you know Princess Charlotte was already betrothed to Orange?
I did not.
Although it certainly helps explain why Peter van der Pals was so anxious to get Jane to spy on the princess. Particularly if Charlotte is now regretting having given her consent to the match.
She shifted to loop her arms around his neck.
Speaking of which, you never did tell me precisely what it was about Orange and van der Pals you didn't find it proper to discuss in the middle of Bond Street. Let's just say that if there were no need for Orange to beget an heir, I seriously doubt he would ever marry.
Her eyes widened.
You're certain?
Yes.
Do you think the regent knows?
Oh, he knows all right. Orange has always surrounded himself with attractive, ambitious men like van der Pals. I suspect the real question is, does Charlotte know? And if she doesn't, how would she react if she found out?
Hero's gaze met his.
Not well, I suspect.
That poor girl.
Sebastian nodded.
I can see someone killing Jane Ambrose if they thought she'd learned the truth about Orange and was planning to tell the princess.
He didn't add that the person most likely to order such a killing was Hero's own father. But then he saw the stricken look in her eyes and knew that she had guessed it anyway.
Chapter 14. Saturday, 29th of January. Sebastian began the next morning with an unfashionably early call on Phineas Wallace, 2nd Baron Wallace, the notorious Whig politician mentioned by Liam Maxwell as someone Jane had recently visited. Wallace had first entered the House of Commons as a young man of only 22, freshly down from Cambridge, brilliant, opinionated, and self-confident to the point of abrasive arrogance. He was the fourth son of a famous general, known for his ruthless prosecution of war against everyone, from Jacobites and American rebels to the French. As a younger son, Wallace never expected to inherit his family's modest holdings in Northumbria. And so he had poured his energies and considerable talents into Whig politics, championing everything from the abolition of slavery and Catholic emancipation to public education and electoral reform. Wallace's elevation to his father's newly created peerage had come about unexpectedly when his three elder brothers died childless. In contrast to his brothers, the second Baron was the father of a prodigious number of offspring, 8 sons and 7 daughters by his wife, plus a young woman he claimed as his little sister, but who was known by everyone to be the result of a torrid long-ago affair between Wallace and Georgiana, Duchess of Devonshire, the beautiful, tragic Whig hostess. He was close to 50 now, still trim and attractive in a very English way, with a sharp nose, a small, thin-lipped mouth, and shrewdly analytical eyes. Sebastian knew him slightly through Hendon, who heartily despised the arrogant, outspoken Whig. There was no denying that on a personal level the man could sometimes be abrasive, although Sebastian himself couldn't help but admire Wallace's intelligence and dedication to reform. But what interested Sebastian most about Jane Ambrose's recent visit to Phineas Wallace was the fact that, like his colleague Henry Broom, Wallace had for years served as advisor and protector of the prince's estranged wife, Carolyn.
"Frightfully cold morning," said Wallace with a grimace when he received Sebastian in the simply furnished drawing-room of his Mount Street home. "May I offer you some wine?"
"Please," said Sebastian, going to warm himself before the fire.
"I saw Lady Devlin's recent article on climbing boys," said the Baron, pouring wine into 2 glasses. "She does excellent work. If she were a man, I'd recommend she run for Parliament."
He laughed when he said it, as if the idea of a woman in Parliament were a ridiculous notion.
"I've no doubt she would be extraordinarily effective there," said Sebastian, accepting the glass held out to him. "Even as a woman." "Yes. Well."
Wallace took a judicious sip of his own wine, but over the rim of his glass, his eyes were watchful and assessing.
"I'm told her ladyship had the misfortune of coming upon Mrs. Ambrose's body in the street the other day. Dreadful business, that. I trust she suffered no ill effects."
"You knew Jane Ambrose?" said Sebastian.
"Not really, no."
"Oh, I was under the impression she came to see you recently."
"She did, yes. When one is the father of 15 sons and daughters, it seems one is constantly looking for music instructors, dance instructors, tutors. It never ends."
"She taught your children?"
"She was considering it, yes."
His lips relaxed into a self-conscious smile of paternal pride.
"My wife and I like to think our Elizabeth is exceptionally talented, but nothing was ever formalized, and now the poor woman is dead."
"Except that Jane Ambrose didn't simply die,"
said Sebastian.
She was killed. It's unclear yet whether it was manslaughter or murder, but her death was not the innocent accident the palace would have the public believe.
Wallace's eyes bulged in a credible display of shock.
Good heavens! How terribly disturbing. Is that why you're here? Because you think I might shed some light on what happened to her? I wish I could be of some assistance, but the truth is I barely knew the woman. Who recommended her to you? Ah, said the Baron. That was Princess Caroline. So the Princess of Wales knew Mrs. Ambrose. She did, yes. Caroline has always loved music, especially the piano. How close were they? That, I'm afraid, I couldn't say.
He gave a faint smile that came nowhere near touching those watchful eyes.
Sorry.
When precisely did you say she came to see you?
I don't believe I did say, actually. But it was a week ago, this past Wednesday.
Why?
Are you familiar with Christian Somerset?
Wallace stiffened.
Well, I know who he is, obviously. But I don't consider him a friend, if that's what you're suggesting. Your father, the Earl of Hendon, may not see a difference between the Whigs and the Radicals, but there is one, believe me.
Is Somerset still a Radical?
Perhaps not so much any more. But are you familiar with his former associate, Liam Maxwell?
The older man's features twitched with revulsion.
Just how radical is he? Maxwell? Radical enough that he belongs back in prison, if you ask me.
Wallace indicated Sebastian's glass, which was still half full.
May I offer you more wine?
Sebastian set the glass aside.
Thank you, but no. Sorry I couldn't be of more assistance, said Wallace, walking with him to the stairs.
From the upper floors of the house came the sound of children's laughter and running feet.
Do you know the names of Jane Ambrose's other pupils?
Asked Sebastian, pausing. Wallace shook his head.
No, sorry, I can't help you there.
And that, thought Sebastian, as the stony-faced butler closed the door behind him, was Wallace's most obvious lie. Because what man of the Baron's standing would consider engaging a music instructor for his child without investigating her other students? Even if she were recommended by a princess. Sebastian had no idea why Jane Ambrose had visited Princess Caroline's close confidant a week before her death. But he was fairly certain it had nothing to do with lessons for young Miss Elizabeth Wallace. Increasingly troubled, Sebastian decided to take his questions about the politics of Jane Ambrose's brother and his journalist friend to the well-known political philosopher, William Godwin. He chose Godwin, partially because he had a passing acquaintance with the man, and he admired the writings of Godwin's controversial first wife, Mary Wollstonecraft. But geography also played a part, for Godwin lived on the edge of Clerkenwell, not far from where Jane Ambrose's killer had left her body. This was a section of Clerkenwell that in times past had been dominated by the skinning trade, and the great herds of livestock driven from the countryside in towards Smithfield Market. Now rows of new, small brick terrace houses stood amidst the older timber-frame dwellings dating from Tudor or even medieval times. The vast open expanse of spa fields lay nearby. The walkways and ruined arbours of its abandoned old gardens hidden beneath a clean white cover of fresh snow. Godwin, who'd once been as famous and influential a thinker as Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine, now lived above the children's bookstore and publishing house he kept with his second wife. When Sebastian pushed open the front door with a jingle of its bell, the writer himself was straightening a stack of Greek and Roman fables displayed on a table beneath the frost-covered front window. He was in his late 50s, his hair greying and receding, his once sharp features softened by the slow accumulation of pounds. He looked up as Sebastian shut the door against a gust of frigid air and frowned.
I assume you're here for a reason.
Sebastian carefully knocked the snow off his hat. It wasn't a particularly promising beginning.
I have some questions I'd like to ask you, if I might have a moment of your time.
Godwin grunted and returned his attention to the display table.
Now, why would the son and heir of the great Earl of Hendon be wanting to speak to me? A woman named Jane Ambrose was found dead near here, in Shepherd's Lane.
Godwin nodded with a sigh.
Yes, I know. Sad, isn't it? The streets have been most treacherous lately. They can be, except that Jane Ambrose didn't slip and hit her head. She was already dead when someone dumped her body in the snow.
Godwin gave up straightening the display and turned to face Sebastian, his hands dangling limply at his sides.
You can't think I had anything to do with that. No, I didn't mean to imply that. I'm here because I'm interested in what you can tell me about the newspaper Liam Maxwell used to publish with Jane Ambrose's brother, Christian Somerset.
Godwin began shifting a pile of children's atlases from a crate onto a nearby shelf.
Why? That was long ago. Surely you can't think it has anything to do with what happened. At this point, I don't know. What was the paper called? The Poor Man's Advocate. Was it stamped?
The required stamp tax added 4 pence to a newspaper's cost, which was a staggering sum for papers targeting anyone but the affluent. As a result, papers aimed at the lowest classes were typically sold illegally, unstamped.
Oh, it was stamped, all right, which obviously had the effect of limiting its circulation. The poor of England seldom have excess coins to spend on reading material. But then that's precisely why our benighted government put such a high tax on newspapers in the first place, isn't it? Can't have the masses discovering that others not only share their discontent, but are advocating radical solutions to the nation's problems. How radical was it?
Godwin gave a slow smile.
Compared to what? They argued that Parliament should be representative of the entire kingdom, rather than a tool of the privileged, and maintain that England's true strength lies with the labour of her people, rather than the activities of our rapacious aristocracy. So what sort of reforms were they calling for? A republican government?
Godwin finished straightening the atlases and leaned back against the counter, his arms folded at his chest.
I've no doubt it's what both men wanted. But they never called for it, if that's what you're asking. They mainly focused on things like secret ballots and manhood suffrage, and freedom of the press, of course. Such as the right to call Prinny a fat bastard without landing in prison for 2 years. Something like that, yes. And Maxwell now publishes a different paper. At least one. Or so they say. He's the publisher of The Intelligencer.
Sebastian nodded. The Intelligencer printed unvarnished but careful reports of parliamentary debates and government acts, leavened by sensational accounts of the city's most gruesome crimes and accidents.
And the other?
When Godwin simply pursed his lips and remained silent, Sebastian said,
"Anything you tell me will go no further. My sole purpose is to understand how and why Jane Ambrose died."
Godwin gave a pained sigh.
"Word on the street says he's also responsible for the pig's trough."
"Good Lord," said Sebastian. "The pig's trough was a truly radical, unstamped periodical calling for everything from the abolition of the monarchy to the redistribution of property. Typically hawked in alleys at night, its name was an irreverent reference to Edmund Burke's fondness for the phrase, the swinish multitude."
"I'm not saying the rumours are true, mind you. How would I know? I simply write, publish and sell children's books." "What about Somerset?" asked Sebastian. "Is he involved with the pig's trough?" "Christian? Not likely. These days he confines his publishing business to romances, guidebooks, and floral stationery. He does still write occasionally for the Chronicle. but he's careful what he says.
Sebastian studied the older man's gentle, troubled face.
Did you know Jane Ambrose?
Godwin drew a ragged breath that jerked his chest.
Of course I knew her. She taught my daughter, Mary, piano for years.
She was still teaching her?
Yes.
Why?
On what days?
Friday afternoons.
Is it possible Jane could have been coming here on Thursday evening?
I don't think so. Why would she?
Sebastian could think of several reasons, but all he said was,
How long have you known her?
10 years or more. I met her through Christian.
So you knew her well?
Oh, yes. She frequently lingered after my daughter's lessons to argue philosophy with us. She reminded me in some ways of my first wife when she was that age. Bright and quick, with a rare courage and strength of character. Except, of course, that Jane's thinking wasn't anywhere near as unconventional.
She believed in monarchy.
She did, yes.
I asked her once how she possibly could, given her familiarity with the Prince of Wales.
And?
She said that however great Prinny's failings as an individual, and she acknowledged that his failings were indeed great, she still believed he was dedicated to the interests of his kingdom in a way mere politicians rarely are. I told her a man who has his subjects' best interests at heart does not run up millions of pounds in debt on self-indulgent tripperies while his people starve.
What was her reply?
She insisted that Princess Charlotte would be a different kind of ruler, that unlike her father, she truly is kind and caring, as illustrated by the fact that she actually supports both Catholic emancipation and Irish independence.
She does.
Oh, yes.
She's quite the Whig.
Jane also insisted that Charlotte is sincere in her beliefs, unlike her father in his salad days.
Did Jane ever say anything to you about Prinny's plans for his daughter's marriage?
Not really. I asked her recently if the rumours we're hearing about a possible Orange alliance are true, but she pretended to know nothing about it.
What makes you think she was only pretending?
Godwin's lips twitched into a ghost of a smile.
Jane was always an appalling bad liar. The truth was writ all over her face.
The smile faded away into something bleak and sad.
And now she's just dead.
Who do you think killed her?
Godwin went to stand at the bowed front window, his features solemn, his gaze on the wind-driven snow collecting in the corners of mullions. After a moment he shook his head.
I've no idea.
She never spoke to you of any enemies.
Jane?
I wouldn't have said she had any.
He gave a heavy, pained sigh.
I've always believed that men are not innately evil, that the evil we see in the world around us is the result of our age's benighted social conditions and archaic institutions, rather than some inherent human flaw.
But my Mary never shared my belief in the perfectibility of mankind.
And Jane? Jane told me once that her heart agreed with me, but her head suspected that Mary was probably right.
Did she read your late wife's works?
She did, yes. Although, only quite recently.
I've sensed a change in her these last months, as if she were questioning some of her earlier beliefs, searching for new answers.
The loss of her two boys last year, one right after the other, hit her hard. I think she was still finding her way toward understanding and accepting it.
Sebastian shook his head.
How can anyone understand or accept such a loss?
Perhaps one cannot.
Sebastian settled his hat on his head and turned toward the door.
Thank you for your assistance.
Have I been of assistance?
I hope so. It's a dreadful thing if what you say is true.
She was such a talented, good-hearted young woman. Why would anyone want to kill her?
Sebastian paused with a hand on the latch.
What do you know of her relationship with Liam Maxwell? I assume she knew him through her brother, although he was always far more radical than even Christian, let alone Jane. Yet he and Jane were close friends.
Were they?
I didn't know that. I've always been better acquainted with Somerset than with his former partner. Maxwell's far too much of a rabble-rouser for my taste. I've never believed in initiating change through violence, even before the French Revolution showed us just how ugly that approach can be. But Maxwell does.
He does, yes.
Although he'll tell you he favours the American model over the French version.
Sebastian found himself remembering Maxwell's bitter words on the House of Orange and the destruction of the Dutch Republic, and knew a deep disquiet.
What's the man's background? Maxwell? I believe he spent his early years in India. His father was in the East India Company and his mother was raised there. But both died when he was still a lad. He went to Westminster as a king's scholar.
That can't have been easy.
No, I've always suspected it contributed more than a bit to his radical philosophies.
Probably.
Godwin gave him a hard look.
Why do you ask?
I'm simply trying to understand Jane better. You happened to speak with her last week when she was here for your daughter's lesson?
Godwin shook his head.
She didn't come. She sent a message saying she wouldn't be able to make it.
Did she do that often?
No. Truth is, I can't remember her having done it before. Ever.
Chapter 15. Jarvis was at breakfast in Berkeley Square when his daughter Hero walked into the room and closed the door behind her.
"Did you kill Jane Ambrose?" she asked without preamble, jerking at the ribbons of her black velvet hat.
Jarvis cut a piece of ham.
"I did not.
Well, obviously I don't mean personally."
Jarvis calmly chewed and swallowed.
"The answer is still the same."
"Do you know who did?"
"I do not. And unless her death should somehow threaten affairs of state, nor do I care."
He reached for the stout ale that always accompanied his breakfast.
"Would you like a plate?"
She shook her head. "I've already breakfasted, thank you." But she did push away from the door and come to sit at the table. She was Jarvis's only surviving child. Once he'd had a son, a sickly, peculiar lad named David, who died and been buried at sea years ago. All the other infants his late tiresome wife Annabel had managed to carry to term had either been born dead or died soon after. Annabel herself had been dead 4 months now, and Jarvis had already dispensed with his black sleeve ribbon. Hero still wore full mourning. He had never thought his daughter a particularly attractive woman. She was too tall, her features too masculine, her gaze too direct and unabashedly intelligent. But she did look good in black, and he had to admit that marriage and motherhood had improved her.
"How's my grandson?"
he asked, endlessly curious and fiercely determined.
"Good."
She placed her hands flat on the table and leaned into them.
"Is it true that Prinny has forced Charlotte to agree to marry William of Orange?"
"No one forced her. The princess made the decision of her own free will."
"When given a choice between marrying Orange and being immured with a bunch of foul-tempered old women until she dies, you mean?"
"Well, at least until the Prince of Wales dies. At that point, assuming her poor old mad grandfather is also dead, she will be queen, and thus free to do as she pleases."
"Both of Prinny's parents are still alive. He could live another 30 or 40 years.
"He could."
She fixed him with a fierce gaze.
"Orange can't be a proper husband to her, and you know it. Such a marriage would make her life wretched."
"This isn't about Charlotte's happiness. It's about what's good for the kingdom, not to mention the future of all of Europe."
And you think a miserable union between our future queen and a man known to prefer handsome courtiers will be good for England? Did the disastrous marriage of Prinny and his poor wife teach us nothing?
Charlotte may be stubborn, but like her father, she understands her duty and will do it.
Prinny only agreed to do his duty and marry Caroline because he was drowning in debt and he thought it would convince Parliament to grant him a higher allowance. And when he realized that wasn't the case, he pitched a fit and refused to go near her again.
Yes. Well, fortunately, Charlotte has been raised to be considerably less devoted to her own self-interest. She quite clearly understands that not only will a united Netherlands serve as a useful check against the French and form an important bridge between Hanover and England, but it will also separate France from an increasingly strong Prussia. With the Dutch fleet joined to the Royal Navy, our domination of the seas will be unchallengeable. Holland will be far more stable once it is turned into a monarchy.
Ah, yes. Because the fates of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette certainly illustrated for all just how stable a monarchy can be, said Hero dryly.
And nothing will keep this new, more powerful Dutch kingdom tied to Britain better than a marriage alliance, he finished with a repressive frown.
Hero had never been the least troubled by his disapproval. And if the Dutch people object to having their 200-year-old republic replaced by a monarchy? Jarvis shrugged.
A few judicious whiffs of grape shot will quiet any objections.
Hero regarded him with a thoughtful expression that told him just how well she knew him. After a moment she said,
There's more to this than what you're telling me.
He laughed out loud and reached for his ale without answering her. The opening of the dining room door brought Hero's head around, her features carefully wiped of all emotion when she saw the dainty woman who paused there with one hand on the knob.
Cousin Victoria, said Hero, rising to her feet.
Hero!
Mrs. Victoria Hart Davis came forward with a warm smile to take Hero in an affectionate embrace. A stunningly beautiful widow in her late 20s, she was a distant cousin of Hero's dead mother and had been visiting at the time of Annabel's death. Because Jarvis's own mother, the Dowager Lady Jarvis, was too old and arthritic to leave her rooms much these days, Cousin Victoria had kindly offered to stay and help run the household until someone suitable could be found. Jarvis was in no hurry for her to leave. She was so tiny that even when she stood on tiptoe, her kiss didn't quite reach Hero's cheek, and she laughed good-naturedly.
What a pleasant surprise. You're joining us for breakfast?
Sorry, no, said Hero, reaching for her hat. I can't stay.
You and Devlin must come for dinner. Perhaps one evening when this wretched cold snap has passed?
Yes, said Hero. That would be lovely.
After she had gone, Victoria came to stand behind Jarvis's chair and slip her arms around his neck. Does she know?
Not all of it, he said,
and smiled when she playfully bit his ear. Chapter 16
Long the haunt of booksellers and literary men, Paternoster Row was an ancient, gloomy thoroughfare lying just to the north of St. Paul's Cathedral. The narrow, gable-fronted residence of Jane's brother, Christian Somerset, stood not far from Ave Maria Lane. Its ground floor was given over to Somerset's bookstore and bindery, while his printing press operated from a workshop that opened onto a small court at the rear. Sebastian found the shop busy, with several men working two modern iron-framed presses, while young apprentices leapt to ink the blocks and then peel off the fresh, wet pages and hang them to dry. A slim, quietly dressed man stood near the front window, frowning as he held a proof sheet up to the light. When Sebastian pushed open the door from the snow-filled courtyard, the man glanced up and said, "May I help you?" Sebastian closed the door against the icy cold and breathed in the thick atmosphere of linseed oil, lamp black, and sweat.
You're Mr. Christian Somerset.
The man's hand trembled slightly as he set the sheet aside.
I am, yes.
The family resemblance was there in the finely drawn features and elegant bone structure Somerset shared with his dead sister. But if Sebastian hadn't known the man was younger than Jane, he never would have guessed it, for Somerset's dark hair was already laced with grey, and life had etched early lines of strain and disillusionment in his gentle face. Sebastian held out one of his cards.
I'm Devlin.
Ah. Somerset nodded as he took the card.
Liam Maxwell told me you might be paying me a visit.
He cast a quick glance at the men working the presses and said in a lowered voice,
Please, come this way.
He led Sebastian to a small, untidy office warmed by a rusty stove and filled with stacks of invoices, reams of paper, and crates of unbound books ready to be shipped. Most publishers sold their books in plain paper wrappers with temporary sewing, for permanent bindings were typically left to booksellers or to private buyers who took the books to their own binders and had them covered in leather to match their personal libraries. But Sebastian could also see stacks of inexpensive guidebooks bound in plain cloth covers, which was something of an innovation. Somerset nodded to a bench of an elegant pianoforte, which stood like a calm in the midst of a storm.
Have a seat, please. I should probably stand, said Sebastian, swinging off his greatcoat. I'm rather wet.
Somerset pressed one splayed hand against the top of his cluttered desk as if bracing himself for what he was about to hear.
Is it true, then? Jane was murdered? It's either murder or manslaughter. It's difficult to say which. Oh, dear God.
His voice cracked, and he swiped a hand across his mouth and looked away, blinking.
Poor Jane.
Sebastian said,
When was the last time you saw your sister?
Somerset sighed.
I'm afraid it's been some time, perhaps as much as 10 days.
She came here.
For any particular reason?
Somerset nodded.
I publish her music. She brought a collection of new ballads she'd written.
Sebastian glanced at the piano.
You play.
Somerset gave a wry, self-deprecating smile.
I do, for my own pleasure. But I'm nowhere near Jane's level, if that's what you're asking. Growing up with Jane and James ahead of me was rather intimidating, I suppose. Besides, I always wanted to be a writer. Do you still write?
Oh, yes.
Although I'm careful these days what I say and how I say it. I spent 2 years in prison for the sin of speaking my mind, and it's not an experience I care to repeat. Did Jane share your political views?
Jane? Somerset gave a huff that wasn't quite a laugh.
She taught piano to Princess Charlotte and to Princess Amelia before she died. What do you think?
I think one can take advantage of the prestige afforded by instructing members of the royal family and still quietly nurture radical ideals.
Not Jane. Oh, there's no denying she loathed the regent. A free Englishman can still say that, can't he? But she was a firm believer in the institution of monarchy. Did she ever talk to you about the princess? I know she had a genuine affection for the girl. She didn't say anything to you about Charlotte's betrothal. Is she betrothed? I haven't heard that. It's not well known, said Sebastian.
It was telling, he thought, that Jane had discussed her concerns about Charlotte's betrothal with her brother's former partner, but not with her brother himself. Although he suspected that said more about her relationship with Liam Maxwell than anything else.
What about her other students? Did she talk about any of them?
Not that I recall, no.
Not even Anna Rothschild?
No.
Sorry. I know she taught her, but beyond that...
His voice trailed away and he swallowed hard.
She was typically very discreet when it came to her pupils.
Sebastian went to stand beside the frosted window overlooking the snow-filled court. From here, he could see the narrow passage that opened onto Paternoster Row.
Do you have any idea what could have taken Jane to Clerkenwell on Thursday?
Somerset thought about it a moment, then shook his head.
I understand that's where they say she was found.
but I can't imagine what she was doing there. Any friends or relatives in the area?
Well, the Godwins live there, and I know Jane teaches their daughter, taught their daughter, he corrected himself softly. Perhaps that's where she was going. Except that Jane's lessons with Mary Godwin were on Fridays, not Thursdays.
Ah, I didn't.